My name's Fred Benenson. Can you hear me all right? No?
Louder?
Closer? Closer? Is that closer? Hello? Hello? Okay. Sorry. Okay. So my name's Fred Benenson. I just graduated NYU in May, where I started a free culture club. We'll be talking about free culture, the organization, in a bit. But I'm working for Creative Commons over the summer, and I'm going to be heading back to New York in a bit. But I've been interested in kind of open source, free software, everything in terms from hacking to, I don't know, graphic design since high school when I was reading 2600 and stuff, and that kind of what got me into it. But I don't know. Here's Elizabeth.
Hey, everybody. My name's Elizabeth Stark. Firstly, I'm kind of losing my voice, so please forgive me, or if you can't hear me, let me know. I am a current law student at Harvard Law School, who apparently needs to check up on their SSL connections. But I'm also extremely interested in the issues surrounding law, culture, and technology. I'm kind of a culture junkie myself. I went to Brown University and am helping out freeculture.org. I am looking to start a chapter at my school next year, but currently doing a lot of work with the organization and representing them here.
All right, so we came up with this idea to give a speech here because we wanted to kind of bring free culture to another community, and we see DEF CON as a kind of great community of like-minded technology folk. So let's get started about what free culture actually means. First of all, this is not in particular order, but it's a book written by Lawrence Lessig, famous law professor from Harvard. He taught at Yale. He went to Yale, taught at Harvard. Now he teaches at Stanford. He also runs Creative Commons. So he's written a couple books. He's working on another one called Code, but his most famous one is called Free Culture. Free Culture also means the student movement that we're participating in. And it all started from a lawsuit at Swarthmore.
But at first, we'd like to clarify, though, we do not claim to be the entire, quote-unquote, free culture movement. We are one student organization within the movement that is composed of professors, academics, artists, technologists, all different types of people that are interested in the issues relating, say, to copyleft, to free culture, not as in free beer, but more like free trade. And we are a part of that movement. Sometimes we are accused of claiming that we created the movement.
No, that's not really the case. We're here representing freeculture.org, which you can see up on the site. If you want more information, kind of dig through there. But hopefully we'll give you some here. I'm going to describe how it kind of came about, what college students were first involved in it, because it's actually kind of an interesting story. I'm going to quote from an article on motherjones.com about two students at Swarthmore College named Luke and Nelson. Here, I'll read from the article. The adventure began in spring 2003 when a hacker broke into Diebold's computer system and unearthed 15,000 internal emails. In them, Diebold employees fret over the voting machine's vulnerability to hackers and their alarming habit of going on the fritz. "I need some answers," one employee wrote from Florida regarding the 2000 recount. Quote, Precinct 216 gave Al Gore minus 16,022 votes when it was uploaded. "Will somebody please explain this to me so I have the information to give to the auditor instead of standing there looking dumb?" That's the text in the memos that were published online. So it was a big deal because these memos kind of exposed a glaring flaw in our voting process, and you know, for all the insanity that went on during the Bush versus Gore election in 2000, it was a really big deal to kind of think that the voting machines were broken. I mean, who knows what could have happened if anybody established anything. So Diebold was responsible for these voting machines that went on the fritz. The memos got left open for the technically minded in a open FTP directory with no password. Enough people downloaded it and started passing around that it became kind of like buzz on the internet. Luke and Nelson at Swarthmore picked up on it because they were familiar with the movement and that kind of thing. They put it on their website. And,
so did Derek.
Yeah, so did Derek. Everyone was posting on their website. Obviously, Diebold freaks out and starts sending cease and desist letters. And the cease and desist letters were really interesting because they weren't trade secrets cease and desist letters. They were copyright infringement cease and desist letters, which is pretty much claiming that the internal memos from Diebold had original art that they were trying to claim copyright on. And by posting it on a website, you're infringing on the copyright. It's a kind of a big difference between copying CDs and publishing memos.
But as we know, large content companies would send cease and desist letters to people, even if they don't have a valid copyright argument, because they want to scare people away. And this is pretty much the argument in this situation. These were college kids, other ISPs. When they first sent the letter to Swarthmore, they, I think, immediately took down.
Right. Swarthmore freaked out, and, you know, as any university or college would probably freak out. They contacted the students and took it down, and Luke and Nelson kind of, you know, bit their lip and played by their game for a bit, but then realized that they, you know, should stand up for it. So then they posted the memos up on another site. I'm not sure where, but it was a big deal because they were kind of standing up to this big, evil, Republican corporation. And you know, they're just some...
We're a nonpartisan group, by the way.
Yeah, we're a nonpartisan group, but, you know, it was these two kids from a liberal arts university getting threatened by a Republican corporation. It was a fascinating point. Anyway, so instead of getting sued by Diebold, what happens is that they actually sue Diebold under a provision called 512F, which Elizabeth will talk about.
So as we all know, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, otherwise known as the DMCA, has a lot of provisions that we don't like. There is something written into it called 512F that this was the first case to actually test the provision where if you are accusing copyright infringement where it is so basically obvious that this is not a case of infringement, as if you're bullying someone, which I think Diebold in this case clearly
qualified as bullying.
I think a lot of other content companies are doing that as well, but you can sue under this provision. The EFF stepped in as well, and David over here testified for the EFF in the case, so we have a lot of supporters here. And they won the case. The court basically said this is an obvious fair use, so obvious that they could not have thought that it was an actual copyright infringement.
One of the big deals was that the information that was released was actually in the public interest. I mean, it wasn't just some trade secret like, you know, Apple's new design for the Shuffle, which is questionably in the public interest. It was something that actually had to do with, you know, voting and the next president and that kind of thing. So it definitely qualified as fair use. And good news is
they got back attorney's fees and also...
Right, they won the lawsuit, got back attorney's fees, and won some money for themselves, I think. So that kind of started a, you know, it was a sensation at Swarthmore. I mean, it was such a small college and that these kids were in magazines, New York Times magazine. It was a huge deal. And they realized that there was really a demand for students who are interested in kind of the future of copyright, online, internet technologies and everything, that there was really a demand for like a political movement. So they had, during the Diebold trial, Nelson and Luke had started a group called the Swarthmore Coalition for the Digital Commons.
Not so easy to say.
But after garnering so much public and national attention, they decided to just rename themselves to FreeCulture.org and start a national organization. And so that's kind of how, like, the beginning of the organization worked, is the Nelson and Luke kind of worked hard to kind of get it going at Swarthmore and then started up an email list and got stuff posted on Slashdot, and that's how I found out about it. I'd been kind of interested. Lessig's blog posted about it.
Although, one thing I'd like to clarify is, as much as we definitely admire the work of Professor Lessig and we have read his books and whatnot, he is not the head of our organization. Some people have accused him of basically rounding up students to be his quote-unquote sheep. That is not what we are.
This is pretty far from the truth, and he consistently denies that he has, you know, anything to do with kind of our big decision making and that kind of thing. I mean, we named our club after his book. It's an important document, as far as we're concerned, but there is a lot of difference between Lawrence Lessig and Free Culture. So, just a minor point, but our goal is to try to make it as student oriented as possible and try to keep our board of directors, when we decide on one, as kind of young and hip and in with the college and university crowd as possible. So
and grad school.
And grad school. Well, university, so. So basically this email list starts going around in the, I guess it's the summer of 2004, and I get on it, and I was interested in doing stuff at NYU because I pulled an April Fool's prank that was, it was a poster from the RIA saying, trade in your MP3s and we'll give you iTunes credits, and it was this really, you know, elaborate prank, and we put up posters everywhere, and people really responded to it, and I kind of realized then that students are interested in this. This is a topic that people are talking about and arguing about, and it was actually at the heat, that the top of all the lawsuits going against college students for file sharing. So I coordinated. I got something started at NYU, and kind of went from there. We're now a club at NYU. There's an umbrella organization called freeculture.org, which kind of helps manage everything. And Elizabeth and I are in, like, the core committee, and we kind of work from there. And then we also have a main discuss list that people kind of post links and argue on and that kind of thing. And I highly encourage you to join it because it's a very interesting list with a lot of kind of up-to-date stuff on it.
And we currently have 13 chapters across the country, and a lot. Firstly, we have countless students from other schools who are interested, who are trying to start up chapters, who participate in the discussions and the meetings that we have. And we also have a lot of international interest, especially from, for example, the UK. I think somebody just started freeculture.org.uk, and they're working on a project out of, I think, where is this? Essex?
No. I'm not sure.
Okay. And we also have people in South America. As some of you may know, South America is extremely interested in, for example, in Brazil and Argentina, the free software movement and free culture movement. So we have a bunch of people interested from there.
So as opposed to explaining kind of our origins, let's get a little bit more specific. We see ourselves as do-it-yourself politics. I mean, that's really the nature of a grassroots organization, is that you kind of identify a problem you have with society or policy or law, and you kind of go from there. And our main goal is to reform copyright law and kind of pave the way for sensible technology and
to educate people about the alternative,
right,
and how we can work toward a greater, like, public domain and freedom of information.
And as students, we're a concerned party. We're worried that governments, corporations, and even individuals are making bad choices about how this stuff is happening. And these choices threaten to stagnate future progress and innovation in ways that we haven't really known before, or we won't even ever know. So basically, we came to DEF CON because we think hackers should care about free culture. And we see kind of our goals as an organization very similar to a lot of the sentiments in the hacker community. And one of the biggest things is that hackers tout is their right to be curious and explore the technology that we're using, or that they're using. And we feel that as a main tenet of culture and technology. So where hackers mainly explore code and systems and that kind of thing, we like to encourage the idea of exploring culture and taking and using culture in similar ways as
and
a hacker.
Code.
And code. So from that point on, I guess we're going to talk about some examples of what we consider culture hacking. People taking bits of culture and remixing them and reusing them in ways that they were originally unintended. And to that end, we have a lot of kind of media that we're going to show and kind of entertaining stuff from the history of what we like to call culture hacking. First, I'm going to, you know, bear with me if you guys feel like this is kind of too close to an art history presentation, but hey, I don't think a lot of other people are talking about art history at DEF CON, so here we go. Get ready. Fade in. Oh, yeah. Okay, so some of you may be familiar with this image, some of you may not be. As far as I know, this is one of the first blatant uses of a remix in Western art. And this is by an artist named Marcel Duchamp. This is actually Picasso's getting feisty. Okay, so Marcel Duchamp did this in the early 1900s. He was a prolific artist, dabbling in a lot of different genres, but this was a postcard remake of the Mona Lisa, and it looks huge now, but it's actually incredibly tiny. And he basically drew a mustache on her and wrote L-H-O-O-Q at the bottom. And when pronounced phonetically in French, that means she's
Elle
got
a... un bon cul.
There you go. And when pronounced phonetically, that means she's got a hot ass, right?
A nice ass.
A nice ass. So this is one of my favorite pieces of work, art, because it ties in so many ideas that were just coming of age in the early 1900s. The idea that art is getting whittled down to postcard size, and this would be something you'd send one of your friends from the Louvre and that kind of thing. But it was Duchamp kind of mocking this and kind of coming up and saying that, well, maybe this is art too. And so, you know, even though he just drew a mustache on her, it became a famous piece of art, and he was widely recognized as being brilliant for this. So,
and let's clarify something. When you said this is one of the first remixes in modern art, I think we take the position that almost all art and all culture is derivative in some way or another.
I guess I meant in a literal remix sense, is that this is a sample in its most literal sense. And before this, my personal opinion is that most music remixes itself on a metaphorical level. You're always referencing what Beethoven did or Mozart did and that kind of thing. So anyway, Duchamp did some more cool stuff. This is pushing it a little bit farther. This is a urinal he took from a public metro station, I think, in Paris, and basically wrote R. Mutt on it, which was one of his pseudonames that he released art under, and put it on display. And he got it into a museum or a gallery, I think, and it was a sensation. It blew people's minds in Paris. Like, people were so angry and excited. And
how could
just,
a urinal be art?
Yeah. It was just on the, you know, like the tip of everyone's tongue in the art scene in the early 1900s. And I think recently, I can't remember who said it, but this was voted the most influential piece of modern art in the 20th century. And, you know, it's a urinal, but it's the idea of appropriating something that's already been created. And Duchamp was one of the first kind of artists to do this. And our position is, what if copyright laws were as strict as they are now, back then? I mean, would Duchamp really have gotten away with this? I mean, obviously the Mona Lisa's in the public domain, but who knows about the manufacturer of the urinal? They probably could have sued him. Next up, I'm not sure. I think the original design of the art, well, that's for another one to debate. So this is a shovel. This is another Duchamp piece. It's a snow shovel. He got it in a museum. I think it's pretty cool. And this is one of the most famous pieces of modern art I'm sure you all recognize. This is Andy Warhol. I think he did this in the middle of the 60s. He pretty much just took a picture of a Campbell's soup can, got it into a silkscreen format, and made a ton of silkscreen canvases with the Campbell's soup can logo on it. And this was a huge deal because people just loved the idea that he was representing consumer products as art, and it was extraordinarily controversial, just like Duchamp was, and people couldn't understand why somebody would put up a soup can and call it art. But times, you know, kind of, it's lasted over time, and everyone kind of accepts it as like an important part of art. Campbell's at the time didn't object. They were like, this is great, somebody's found a novel way to use our soup can.
Yeah, they didn't sue. Instead, they found it as, you know, promotion for their product. It's like free advertising.
They thought it as great marketing. I kind of have a funny story to tell about this, but I'll save it for the end. This is another example of Warhol's art. It's a Brillo. I think these are larger than life. Yeah, he scaled these up, so it's just the idea of turning like a small soap pad into a large kind of box. Just more appropriation art. More of Warhol stuff. I mean, these are worth hundreds of thousands of dollars now. I mean, not to say that money is the good value. Or here's him, Warhol himself. I'm sorry about the JPEG compression on that. It's ugly. More Campbell's soup can. He's just kind of going crazy with this stuff. Everyone loves it at the time. Another famous Warhol painting. This is actually interesting because he's using a celebrity's image, and there's a whole debate going on right now. It's kind of like cutting-edge copyright. I'm sorry, not copyright, but law debate about publicity images and whether or not celebrities can kind of claim ownership of what they look like and that kind of thing. And I don't think he got permission from Marilyn Monroe from this at all. And who knows if she would have objected. I mean, blue eyeliner is kind of hard to deal with or whatever it is. I don't think he got permission for this one either.
I'm thinking no.
All right, on to Jean-Michel Basquiat. He's another influential painter of the 20th century in America. He was actually good friends with Andy Warhol. There's some great books and information about Jean-Michel. He lived in the East Village, and so I kind of picked up on his stuff. If you look in the bottom right-hand corner of this image, I'm sorry, the Picasso stuff, the overlay is kind of taking over, but there's a little copyright down here. Yeah. Jean-Michel was obsessed with copyright and kind of like the idea that images were copyrighted and that he could use them and kind of claim domain over them in his own painting. So over and over and over again, you see his use of words and mass consumer ideas put into his art as kind of a appropriation. And people at the time saw this as kind of similar to what hip-hop was doing. We were using these samples from, you know, current life, and we're putting them into our art.
What time was this?
This was like mid-80s. Jean-Michel died in 87 at the early age of 27 from a heroin overdose. He was a real rock star. This is some more of his work. He just basically opened up books and picked out words and put them in there, and he also used images, and he was a prolific graffiti artist in New York City at the time. Here's a picture of him with Warhol. They were really good friends. They both kind of dug on the idea of appropriation. Some more Basquiat. Universal up there is one of my favorite of his. I guess he really loved movies. So I think Universal probably didn't sue him on this or didn't even bother, because
he even put the trademark notice.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, his infatuation with trademark and copyright is throughout all of his stuff. Who knows if he would have gotten away with this now. All right, so that's the end of my slideshow. Okay. Before I kind of get off the art kick, I'm going to talk about a contemporary artist that's doing similar stuff in New York City named Corey Archangel. Corey does some really cool stuff with Nintendo ROMs. He pretty much reprograms Nintendo ROMs to be art. And he got one of his pieces was called the Nintendo Clouds, and he got it into the Whitney Biennial in like 2002, I believe. And it was pretty much Mario without Mario or anything except for the clouds. And I had a picture of it. Let me see if I can get it. Anyway, it was just like a Nintendo cartridge playing the clouds over and over and over again. And the music was playing, and it was kind of a sensation. That was all you really saw. But it was running from a real Nintendo, and they had this whole setup in the Whitney where there's just a Nintendo thing sitting there. So this is just a great example of kind of contemporary appropriation art. And
this pretty much took the New York art scene, well,
by
certain
storm.
Parts of it, yeah.
Yeah, Corey got pretty famous pretty quickly. And recently in February, he just launched this, he just showed this new piece of art. It's a 15-minute Mario movie where Mario goes to a rave. And it's a little bit too long to play here, but he pretty much disassembled the entire Mario cartridge, reprogrammed it to himself, used all the sprites however he wanted, wrote new music. It's an incredible use of appropriation art. So I'm going to show it now and hope that the music's not too obnoxious for you guys. Oh, that doesn't look good. Okay. So this is the intro. I'm going to fast forward a little bit. So a lot of the themes in this piece of art is that Mario and his images are kind of functions of our collective memory right now, and they're all deteriorating. So Corey's idea is to kind of like rejuvenate them. So a lot of themes are kind of like this deterioration and that these memories are getting lost. So he uses a lot of kind of corruption of the actual image, and it's not that he's, you know, like not a good programmer or didn't do it properly. It's that he wants to kind of reinforce the idea that we're losing the idea of Mario to nostalgia and that kind of thing. So I'm going to fast forward a little bit. This is Mario falling. He's just done some really neat stuff. I mean, this is like pushing the Nintendo to its limits. There's a whole narrative going on here. This is like Mario looking around for stuff. You know, this is kind of a bad part for him.
Is this like a bad trip or something?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you'll see. So he's about to take a mushroom, I think. So he's going to this rave, and he's on his way there. eventually he gets there. He's got to go through a lot of castles, and there's a lot of jokes about the princess, because as anyone who's played Mario knows, the princess is always the objective. So it gets pretty intense, and this is all just with 86. I think it's called 8602 assembly, which looks like the most nasty assembly you've ever seen.
We included the code.
Yeah, if you get the CD that DEF CON hands out, you can download the ROM and do whatever you want with it. So this is pretty intense. Basically, when he gets to the rave, it's just Pong. So. So it's kind of a meta video game. Right. It's kind of a
rave scene.
The original video game, right? So Corey kind of operates in a copyright vacuum. I mean, I've talked to him a lot about this stuff, and I mean, he just kind of wants to make art using Mario and that kind of thing, and it's questionable whether or not Nintendo cares. I mean, as far as I know, there's no official comment from Nintendo.
He has not gotten any letters.
There are no cease and desist letters yet.
I mean, in theory, it could be the Walhart-esque key in promoting Super Mario Brothers.
Right, but the real question is whether or not Corey's work falls under fair use, and I believe it does. I mean, this is transformation. Fair use is a whole other big debate, but
I think they could have a decent case.
Yeah, I think Corey could have it. I mean, Nintendo might have it. Yeah. The fact that he's using Mario's image so blatantly is really a big deal.
Especially the clouds. I think the clouds would not win under fair use.
So Corey's done a lot of other really neat hacks with video game cartridges. One of his more abstract ones is hacking Nintendo a Tetris cartridge so that the internal timer of the Nintendo slows it down, so it's like super slow Tetris, and it takes like 10 minutes to do one line.
So you can always win,
yeah. So check him out. We'll have some links up that we can send you guys. But just a kind of contemporary example of appropriation art. Alright, did you want to... Okay, so next we have a video from Matt Bosch, who Elizabeth will talk about. It's very similar kind of video game art.
Right. We're not solely advocating for video game art. I think these are two examples of combining technology and culture, which is something that we very much support at our organization. I mean, we are talking about art and culture, but I must say the main focus of a lot of the issues that we've discussed is surrounding technology. So this is entitled Persistent Artifacts by Matt Bach. It's currently in the New York Video Festival. And here he's mixing a childhood video with his first video game called Adventure on the Atari 2600. I don't know if any of you played it. Woohoo! He identifies that it's the shell of his past identity as an adolescent computer geek. He's actually probably now a 20-something geek. But, and he portrays this experience and interaction like when he was a child playing the video, and this is his interpretation, playing the game of it, and you can probably see now his image coming through from a family home video. This is an homage to the early lone Atari developers, as he put it, who created the games that shaped many of our childhoods, but many of whom remain unknown as a result. Apparently the author of Adventure, named Warren Robinette, refused to be forgotten, and he actually implemented one of the first Easter eggs in this game. Because Atari would not credit the developers for the game, he hid his name in a secret room in the game, creating the first Easter egg. You can find the hidden signature by using a certain item in a specific room. Unfortunately, I don't have the details. I can try to find out. And subsequently, he did leave Atari, but I guess his legacy still remains in the game. And I think this is also, in a way, Matt's reaction to how corporations were not giving the developers credit for their work, and they were kind of taking the hands out of the creators. And he wanted to kind of memorialize that as well in this work and reflect upon his experiences in doing so.
So you know, we're kind of showing all these examples of art and that kind of thing. I mean, there are entire genres of music and that rely on appropriation and sampling. I mean, hip-hop is one great example. Electronic music, I mean, there's kind of this great kind of brotherhood going on with electronic music where you can remix anything and get away with it and nobody's going to sue you for copyright infringement. And it's...
Well,
I mean,
at this point,
it depends which fringes you get to. I mean, if you get more poppy, it's more probably more likely that you'll get sued for copyright infringement. But there's a great wealth of electronic music that can be remixed, and nobody will kind of think twice about
first,
it.
First, the genre of hip-hop would probably not exist today if people were not allowed to sample, and there were such, perhaps.
Right. There's a great book called Copyrights and Copy Wrongs by Siva Vaidyanathan.
Who's a huge fan of hip-hop, by the way.
Right. He's a huge fan of hip-hop, and he writes this kind of history of copyright in the context of how it kind of gives birth to hip-hop, or lack thereof. How it might have prevented the birth of hip-hop.
I mean, hip-hop is predicated upon sampling others' work, right?
Right. So, basically, what does culture and what does free culture have to say to the hacker community, and why have we showed you all this art and that kind of thing? The big thing that we see, the big important part, is that we see culture as technology. We see technology as an important part of our world, but one that hackers are fighting to kind of keep open. And what's that? Oh, I'm sorry. We're going to get music up. Okay, so we're going to play some music that's kind of indicative of remix culture and that kind of stuff in the background, so you guys don't get too bored. I'm sorry. So hackers fight to kind of keep technology open and investigable, and they can go look and poke around, that kind of thing. And our fear is that maybe people don't really think about how culture works that way. And you need to have culture open and kind of you can play around with and that kind of thing. And I don't know. This is an example. This music in the background is the Avalanches. They've sampled over 1,000 samples to make this record. It's a great record called Since I Left You. You should pick it up.
Essentially, it is a collage of samples. In fact, they did clear, from what I understand, even a Madonna sample, which is really hard to find.
Apparently, it was
Madonna
a huge
just
hassle.
Will not let you clear samples. Right. But part of the problem is the way that the current system works. It was extremely difficult to clear all the samples. I know a lot of releases that are delayed, or maybe they'll have to take out tracks because it is just not possible to do so. And we feel that we really enjoy this kind of music. No, it may never be on the top 40. That's fine. You know, we're not advocating that it should be on MTV 24/7.
Right. A lot of people kind of think that, well, why don't you go make music and just do whatever you want and kind of not worry about copyright? Like, what if you just did that? Like, you know, could you... Why does copyright have to be such a big deal? And our fear as an organization is that it's really going to sway a lot of people who don't really want to be illegal rebels and don't really want to kind of break the law to make music. I mean, some people are not as radical as you might be or we might be at DEF CON and that kind of thing, and really just want to play by the rules. But if everything's kind of locked down and there's this increasing threat of copyright lawsuits, then they're going to be much less encouraged to kind of make new art. And the hacker community really thrives on the underground. And it's really kind of a big part of the idea is to remain kind of under the surface. But to the extent that you can do that in culture, it's not as rewarding because culture is meant to be seen and heard.
You can post a mix anonymously online and people can listen to it, but there's always an issue of identification.
Right. There's always going to be this problem of how do you disseminate culture properly. And with the really good hacks and that kind of thing, they're under the surface and you might not even ever know about them, and that's why they're good. That's not how culture works. So the worry is that if you just want to keep kind of working in the underground, and we totally like underground and obscure music and that kind of thing, but if you want to keep avoiding the spotlight because you're afraid of a lawsuit, that kind of thing, it's going to really kind of shortchange your mission as an artist. And our goal as an organization is to really kind of encourage and foster the environment in college campuses and hopefully on a larger scale in the American public, where remixing and hacking your video games and that kind of thing is looked upon as just the next step. It's just another tool in the artist's kind of briefcase of pain and that kind of thing. So I guess I wanted to kind of or talk about CC Mixter, which is a kind of site that Creative Commons is running. If any of you are musicians or artists or anybody who just likes to tinker with music, CC Mixer is a kind of a cool site where you can go and set up an account and download samples that are all CC licensed, and you can do whatever you want with them and put them back up. And it's kind of like a social networking. It's like the Flickr, but for music, I mean, hopefully. The music I'm playing now, Let's Take It Back by Ashwan. Ashwan's a great artist on there. He's done like tons of tracks. The stuff's always awesome. He made a track about the London bombing maybe 2 or 3 hours after they happened and uploaded it onto Mixter. And it's just a really great kind of little environment where people can kind of, you know, remix and not worry about the copyright stuff. So that's one of the, just like the possible alternatives.
To, what license? Do you know what license he's using?
I think he primarily uses non-commercial attribution, which means you can remix his stuff.
But in this case, if you're planning on selling his music, if you were here for the last presentation,
right, you're probably not okay, right, to sell it.
So it's definitely a compromise.
It's a better way because he gets to make awesome music, put it online, have, you know, thousands of people, if not hundreds of thousands of people download it every week, and it's kind of the ideal that we want to see happen on college campuses, is that people kind of sidestep these problems with copyright for the sake of creating a pool or participating in a pool of culture that's much more kind of valuable and important, because it's less regulated.
And a lot of people have said, well, you know, more culture is not necessarily better culture, and of course we would advocate for everybody to create their own work. But it's true, not everything out there. I mean, there have been some internet phenomena where you have some Bulgarian guys singing. Has anybody seen this video?
It's this kid singing a traditional Bulgarian song or something, but it's been remixed into techno, and it's kind of funny and sad and weird at the same time.
It became an internet phenomenon somehow, and not that we're judging it.
Right. It's up there with all your bass as far as I'm concerned, but the question is whether or not that could happen. I mean, imagine the poor kid got sued for making that video because he was singing, you know, the techno remix of a traditional song. I mean, it's crazy. Our feeling is that even though there might be more culture out there with more Creative Commons licensing and that kind of thing, the kind of general way social networks work and the internet works is that the best stuff will kind of come to the top. And CC Mixter, among other software packages, is really designed to encourage people to participate and comment and rate stuff. And it's not just like this kind of mass of stuff that's kind of unrated and unjustified. You can trust your friends to recommend that kind of thing. This is AccuFun, who...
I think they also use about 100 samples per song. Essentially what they do is they take really small snippets of music and then... I'll make it louder. Mix it together such to create an entire song like this. I do not know the copyright status if they did clear the samples, but I'm thinking because they're almost non-recognizable, they probably did not. We also have 2073. Another artist using a lot of samples. And I'd like to say these are not mainstream artists. I mean, I don't know if you've heard of a lot of these people, but they definitely are getting attention in artistic circles. And again, some people have said, well, what if you want all this culture to be mainstream? I mean, isn't the point to be underground? And if you're going to be underground, you can still do things illegally. But we feel that there's a general chilling effect in society that...
Right. I mean, like I was saying before, the idea that the kind of bedroom rocker is going to be suppressed into not making music could be the next John Lennon or something. I mean, who knows what could happen? I mean, there's such there's such propaganda coming out of the content industry right now that downloading music is illegal. I mean, that's really like the exact text of their, you know,
and if you
lawsuits.
Go to CC Mixer, you can download a lot
you
of legal music.
As much legal music as you want. I mean, it's endless, the amount of legal music that you can download. So our fear as an organization is that there's going to be this kind of atmosphere of actual fear that you can't listen to music that other people make, and that you can't remix it and you can't reuse it, just because a corporation kind of has enough money to send out these propaganda campaigns doesn't mean that people shouldn't be kind of doing what their artistic, you know, sentiments would lead them to, you know.
And plus, there's a large distinction between what was possible, say, 20, 30 years ago and what's going on now. I mean, you know, a lot of you, I'm sure, made mixtapes when you were younger. Those are physical copies. You can only distribute them to however many people you make that copy for.
64 number is the number of generations that you can make a copy of an audio tape with before it will be totally unlistenable. But it's totally different on the internet, as a copy is the exact same thing as the original.
And some people may only intend to put something up on their site for their friends and family, but as we've seen with this Bulgarian techno guy, I highly doubt he wanted like the whole internet to see it. Things can be disseminated very widely and very quickly.
So this kind of leads us to the end of our presentation. What do we want from you guys, and like, what are we kind of talking about? What can you do to help out, that kind of thing? I guess the number one thing is to check out our website, join our email list, start talking to your friends. If you go to college, hey, start a chapter. It's really not that hard. I did it this year. Talk to some administration folk. The people at your school want to see you doing activities and that kind of thing. They really don't think that hard about the politics of your organization. I mean, it depends what university you go to, but more often than not, you could be talking about really radical stuff and just still be calling yourself some organization. They'll give you money. And it's actually a really fun way to meet people and start talking. And the only way we're really going to make a change is if we kind of get enough momentum as an organization ourselves and kind of start doing things, and that's with the help of you guys and your ideas. So
I think you did organize like several events.
Yeah,
year.
I mean, I did a couple events. We downloaded movies from the archive.org and had movie screening sessions. That's just one idea. I know the guys at Swarthmore did a whole remix of The Night of the Living Dead, where it was a kind of a film festival. They did some really neat stuff with that. I'm planning in the fall to bug my non-graduated friends at NYU to start a Creative Commons kind of art show. I mean, there's lots of stuff you can kind of come up with and ideas.
Do you bring Rockstar speakers as well?
No, we didn't get a chance to.
Some
but
other chapters have also brought in speakers on topics such as Rockstar.
Just get panels to your school, get people talking. I mean, there's a kind of a whole great opportunity in college to get political and active, and the movement, the copyleft movement, and the free culture movement has yet to really totally solidify. So there's a lot of opportunity for people who might not otherwise be involved with progressive ideas and that kind of thing to get involved. And they don't have to say that they wouldn't vote for Bush. I mean, they don't have to say that they'll vote for Kerry. I mean, right now it's just like we want more sensible copyright laws. And we
I
want
think
to
people
them.
Across all party lines can agree on that issue. I mean, I don't think it's solely restricted to one side or another of the political spectrum.
One of the really big things that Lawrence Lessig stresses in his book Free Culture is that he advocates a common sense approach to copyright. And more often than not, when there's a lawsuit involving a teenager or a college student in copyright, common sense is really kind of thrown to the wayside. And it doesn't really take a political affiliation to realize that a lot of things that are going on with copyright lawsuits are destructive and cruel. So, one more thing before we close. I'm selling this t-shirt at the EFF booth, so if you'd like one.
Support us, support EFF.
Support EFF and support free culture. Go purchase one. We have mediums and larges. So after that, I guess we can take questions, or we'll talk to anybody who's interested in helping out. Yes. Right.
Well, I think we did make the point that we do believe. I mean, what? Oh.
Okay.
Well, what is the question? I'm sorry. It was a comment.
Okay.
Right.
Well, I think Western music, the comment's talking about how, I'm repeating the comment. The idea is that music that we've been listening to the last 50 years is really just a synthesis of a couple kind of big, small paradigms that started off, and not even paradigms, but exact notes and pieces of music. I mean, how many rock songs from the Strokes to the Rolling Stones have the, you know, 12-bar blues or some variation thereof inside? Right. And it seems now that we have this great kind of opportunity to...
He said it was triggered by electronics and technology.
Oh, I'm sorry. I totally... Anyway, we have this great opportunity now to push that even farther and take the technology and make remixes to really extravagant lengths. And the fear, you know, we're afraid that that's going to kind of get clamped down on by a lot of people who kind of are living with the idea that records and CD sales are it to, you know, the bottom line of culture. And we don't feel that's the case.
Actually, could I ask a question? Were you saying that we were underemphasizing this point? Was that the issue?
Right.
Well, yeah. You're saying, yeah, it's starting to happen with movies. You'll have digital video cameras. The comment was, what is happening with music in the last 50 years is now happening with video. And I think we acknowledge that. And frankly, I don't think our organization would exist or would have existed 20 or 30 years ago, because it is the technology here that has enabled all this production. And now somebody can buy a digital video camera for a couple hundred dollars. It's not going to be the best one, but it is enabling creation on a grassroots level.
So
that is definitely something we are supporting.
We're kind of running out of time, so if anybody has any other quick comments or ideas. Yeah, back there. Yeah, we're big fans of Down on Battle, or at least I am. They've been doing some really great stuff. They're coming out with some really kind of cutting-edge software that's going to let people share media and push the limits of remix culture. And I'm very excited to see what they kind of come out with. So, yeah, check out our website, then check out Downhill Battle.
They're friends of ours. We actually have some shirts for sale at
the contact
EFF
us
booth.
If you want some...
Downhill Battle shirts that look kind of like the DEF CON logo, as you can see.
She'll model it.
Home taping
is killing
the music industry.
Not the case.
It's ironic, yes.
Right.
Right, that was a real serious campaign back in the 80s, from what I understand. And I think we've seen that it back then did not kill the music industry. In fact, people heard songs on mixtapes and then went out and bought things and found out about new artists that their friends were telling them about.
So if you guys go to college or want to get involved, please contact us. Talk to us right afterwards. We'd
or
love to hear from
about
you.
About the general issues. We'd always love to hear your comments.
It kind of starts from you guys and us, so we got to start somewhere. So thanks.
Thank you so much for coming to hear us.
Yeah.